Yate Steve Pelletier Yinishe, Mai Dish Gishni Nishli, Billigana Bushishin, Keenla Cheatney Dasha Che, Billigana Dasha Dolly. Welcome back to the Pistons Pod here on Res Ball as Andy and I chop it up, give some fan barometer. We talk about this Muscala release, and then we talk about rotations, what we want to see the rest of the way, and celebrate Cade's excellence so far this season. And I dispel some rumors too about him just being good after coming back from injury. So let's go and get started right now. Welcome back, everybody. Joined here by Andy. We're recording on Leap Year Day, February 29th, 2024. You've probably seen that in the news. There's a lady that's 100 years old. It's actually like 25 because she was born on Leap Day back way, way, way back when. I always thought about that. I wonder how they count their birthdays. But now we know. So, Andy, before we start recording, let everybody know where they can find you. Before we start going, what am I saying? We're already recording.
You can find me on Twitter at D_D_Pistons_fan. All right, let's get it going. What do the people think? What's going on in the world of Twitter?
Yeah, let's look at the fan barometer first. At first, we got a response to one of your tweets, Andy, where you asked, what questions about the Pistons did you have coming into the season that you feel confidently have been answered? To which Wit at Brent Witten, that's at BRENTWHITTEN, responds, question, is Monty the right coach? Answer, no. Question, can Cade and Ivy play together? Answer, yes. Question, are they a year or two away from contention? Answer, no. Question, can Controy complete this restoration? Put in quotes. Answer, no. Next, we have Omari Sankova II said, Monty on finding opportunities for all the new players. Quote, it's too many. You're talking about playing 11 to 12 guys. I can't unless it's a special situation. We'll see how it goes tonight, end quote. Said they had a good practice yesterday to help players get acclimated. And our guy Big Dog Pistons at Big Dog Pistons 1 co-tweeted this saying, special situations, end quotes. I can't. Hashtag Pistons, hashtag Detroit basketball. Aaron Johnson commented on the game against the Pacers on the 22nd of February at A. Johnson NBA, and he said, the Pistons are down 21 points, 13 minutes into the game. Monty Williams has used 11 players. There's the special situations, Big Dog. Detroit had an all-bench lineup on the court 8 minutes into the game. Muscala hasn't played. Cade Cunningham has played 7 minutes. Josh Lloyd at RedRock_Bball says, there have been some bad coaching performances the last few years. Boylan, Bjorken, but Monty has to be up there with the worst. Constant lying, nonsense rotation, stunting development while losing. Piston Thoughts at Pistons Thoughts. That's Pistons, THOUGHTS. Says Monty says a lot of the right things in press conferences, then goes out and coaches doing the complete opposite of what he says. Like he wants to get fired and keep his money. He's been doing this all year. Kofi, who has a great YouTube channel, go look up Kofi. That's at KOFIE. Look up Kofi on YouTube. I think the worst part about Monty is him saying stuff in press conferences, doing the exact opposite and hoping we don't notice. Sam Vecini, The Athletic and the Game Theory podcast, national media member all the way down in Australia. Does a fantastic podcast with our guy, Bryce Simon of Motor City Hoops, who also does the Pistons Pulse at Sam_Vecini. That's at Sam_Vecenie. Says, we are in the midst of a generational bad coaching performance this season from Monty Williams. I feel so sorry for Pistons fans. Thank you for your regards, Sam. Dot Mike at To The Basket Pod says, imagine how many of these close games the Pistons could have won if Monty Williams didn't constantly bleed points with his plethora of stupid decisions. The Pistons are now 4-20 in close games over the last decade. Only the hard-tanking 2015 2016 76ers compare? Pathetic. King I at Trademark Taz says the Pistons have been over 500 exactly one time in the last 15 years. This era of Detroit sports sucks. Hashtag Detroit basketball. King I at Trademark Taz also brought back a tweet from January 29th, 2018 from at Tom Gores. Hey, there's that guy. And in it, it says, we are serious about winning. This is a major move to improve our team. And he's talking about the Blake Griffin trade, to which Mr. King I responds, quote, we are serious about winning, proceeds not to win anything. Duncan Smith at Duncan Smith NBA says, Monty Williams is malicious. Troy Weaver is incompetent. Tom Gores is a drunk. These are very simply difficult obstacles to overcome if you seek to be a competent sporting organization. Hal at Halbridius, that's at Halbridius, says, so they can push Cade out of bounds. Then Cade explains it. The ref ignores it. T on Cade. We can read Cade's lips the entire time. No magic words. It's such a joke, man. The ref says absolutely no accountability. Be bad. Take people's money over and over. Mike Curtis at Mike Curtis 2. Mike Curtis, of course, is the beat writer, Pistons beat writer for the Detroit News. He says, Monty Williams on the no call late in the game, quote, the absolute worst call of the season, to which Dot Mike returns again at to the basket pod. Ask him if having run a bench lineup in the first half that scored 4 points in 5.5 minutes didn't make an enormous difference in the eventual outcome of this game. What a joke. Of course, they're talking about the Knicks game where Dante DiVincenzo tackled Asar at the end. And of course, there's no call. Boho at FC underscore Kate says, can someone explain to me how Embiid gets foul calls just for being touched and how Asar didn't receive one? Vincent Goodwill at Vince Goodwill says, when your guy is that upset and pleading to the refs, the coach has got to take one for the team there. Can't leave Cade on an island. And of course, Vince is talking about Cade pleading to Monty Williams in that Knicks game. Cade Muse at Deuces Muse, that's at DeuceSmuse, tweeted out the clip of it. So go look that up from Cade Muse. Chuck D, Public Enemy. What do you know? We got celebrities here now. Mr. Chuck D at Mr. Chuck D says, Cade and Grimes fit like Grant Hill and Allen Houston. And he's replying to Zarik Xavier. And he says, remember, I told you that, Z. So shout out, Chuck D. Thanks. Hopefully this can be the new Grant and Allen Houston here. Pierre Escargot at the Ethiopian Wolf. That's at DaeEthiopian Wolf. Being a Pistons fan is funny because we acquire guys presumably just for contract math, but we end up playing them significant minutes. Crying face emoji, crying face emoji, laughing crying face emoji, laughing crying face emoji. Amari Sankova II at Amari Sankova says, Pistons essentially gave up 2 seconds to get off the Bagley deal. That was true before they bought out Gallinari and Muscala, but yeah, we'll circle back to that here in a minute. Socialist Pistons at Socialist Stone says, so what in the hell was the purpose of making that trade if we're going to waive all the players we got from it? Albridius returns. They spend real assets to move money that they didn't have to move for any reason at all. Money that Troy himself gave to Marvin Bagley, who was playing well this year before they shut him down. At Tom Gores, do you understand how stupid your front office is? RB the Baller at RB the Baller says, Danilo Gallinari and Mike Muscala had arguably the most positive impact on the season with their shooting from the power forward and center position. Now the Pistons just let them go as if it never happened. LMFAO, playing multiple non-shooting bigs together that are subpar defensively will be the downfall of the score. The whole league seems to be prioritizing shooting and playmaking from every position. Once again, the Pistons play style is 5 to 10 years behind, shaking my head. Sham at Sham Sham God, that's at S-H-A-M-S-H-A-M-M-G-O-D. So, to get Marvin Bagley, the Pistons traded 2 seconds. Josh Jackson, Trey Lyles, now a rotation player for the Kings. Then they traded Marvin Bagley, Isaiah Livers, another 2 seconds. To get the right to buy 2 players out. Troy Weaver's resume is looking like a joke. We'll return to this here in a minute, but just to reiterate, Sham is letting us know in order to get the Marvin Bagley here to Detroit, they sent 2 second-round picks to Sacramento. They sent Josh Jackson. They gave Trey Lyles to them, who's a good rotation piece. And then to get off of Marvin Bagley, they gave away Marvin Bagley, Isaiah Livers, and another 2 second-round picks. That's 4 picks, and then they just waived the guys in that deal anyway. Laz Jackson responds to a Jackson Frank tweet that says, Pistons should prioritize lots of minutes with Quentin Grimes and Simone Fontecchio around the core four over the next 24 games, especially around Caden Dern. Clear 3-and-D wings who fit into those lineups seamlessly and could be in Detroit for the long haul needs to be an emphasis, to which Laz Jackson at L-A-Z-C-H-A-N-C-E, Last Chance, says, everyone sees this. Everyone but Monty Williams. Albertius returns again and says, I'm up at 5 a.m. for work, learning that Muscala's agent is telling him, son, in the fucking course, that's why we're out here glad-handing without a profit, because of all this nepotism. And Duncan Smith quote-tweeted that saying, the Pistons are here to do favors for friends and family and nothing else. And our final tweet comes from Jasper Apollonia at Blade Cunningham. Insane to me that people still are going on about Cade's playmaking. Since Ivy entered the starting lineup, he has a 37.2% assist percentage, would rank fifth in the NBA this year, and a turnover percentage of 13.3%, 45th this season. True shooting nearly at 60% too, fantastic efficiency. It's crazy how much playing next to Killian hurt his numbers to start the season. His three-point shooting is up 10.5%, true shooting up from 51.8% to 59.7%. It's like night and day. You can literally see the jump from the second he was given an actual NBA guard to play next to. Andy, what are your thoughts on these tweets?
They make me feel bad, but I agree with almost all of them. I mean, we won the Bulls game, and I was actually feeling sad. It was very bizarre, because I'm happy that the team won. But how the team won in terms of like our starting lineup. And when I say this about having Stu in the starting lineup, it's not really about Stu. For me, it's more about fit and how the roster works together. But getting that Woj bomb after the game about buying out Muscala, it's like, I don't understand the direction the team is planning to. I mean, I believe if I put the pieces together, I understand the direction the team is moving, which I don't like it. I mean, for me, all signs point to them looking to re-sign Wiseman on some sort of deal next season, because otherwise these moves don't make any sense. And I don't understand that decision. The Bagley trade makes less sense. Buying out Gallinari and Muscala without actually using them as stretch bigs to kind of see how Cade and Ivy look in that sort of environment in a season that wins don't matter, just so you could get an idea to be like, hey, we need some players like this in free agency because this really opened up our offense. Like, nothing they do makes any sense, and it's quite depressing.
Yeah, let's talk about this Muscala deal again. And thank you to Zariq Xavier, who laid it out for us. 2 second-round picks, Josh Jackson and Trey Lyles, in order to get Marvin Bagley. They then pay Marvin Bagley $13.5 million per season. For 3 years, everybody clowns that deal. And then in the final year of that deal, you say, okay, we got to get rid of him, even though he's playing really good. And we're going to give up 2 more second-round picks, and then we're going to get 2 guys back, send him Isaiah Livers, and then just cut these guys. Originally, there's literally nothing for Marvin Bagley, zero, except wasted time. I mean, it just keeps coming back to like our episode titles that the Pistons are really good at wasting time and they miss on the margins every single time. It's maddening, man. Like, I don't even know what to say anymore. But I feel like we're saying the same thing every single episode now of just like, how stupid can you be?
And when you look at the timing of certain things, like they gave Bagley that contract after they traded with New York to get Noel, and they made the trade on draft night to get Durin, and then they offered Bagley that contract, which once you have those 2 other bigs, it'd be like, we have more leverage not to give you a great deal. I mean, we all know that those deals are already done before free agency actually begins. But it just shows that I don't think they really have a plan on what they're doing, because if they do, it doesn't make sense, because it's just reinforced when you look at the guard situation in the offseason where they picked up Monte Morris and they drafted Marcus Sasser and they never traded off Killian Hayes. So it created this logjam and this mess. Like, what they do doesn't make sense.
Yeah, this goes back to me having a problem with the people like always trying to find the positive spin with this franchise now. Like, stop trying to find the positive spin, especially in something like the Muscala deal. Say what it is. It's a waste. It's a waste, and there's no point to it other than just, I don't know, maybe giving a favor to somebody who, like, is your son's client now or whatever. And even then, this whole conversation of, like, oh, it's going to help them win favor with free agents. No, it's not. There's not going to be a single free agent out here that's going to, like, be clamoring come to Detroit, who's had the worst record in a long time here. They had the gigantic losing streak. They seem directionless. Monty Williams has imploded people like Jaden Ivey. He's played guys like Killian Hayes that doesn't seem like they should have earned minutes. There are going to be a lot of guys that are like, I do not want to go to that situation. It doesn't matter how many favors you do somebody. It matters more what happens on the court, how your coach and your organization treat your players. Not like, oh, look at how many guys we bought out. It's absolutely ridiculous.
So, and in terms of, like, just how much they waste time getting to, like, the lineups and the rotations a little bit. So for the Bulls game, they put Stu back into the starting lineup, which, if you're going to do that, I'm fine with it. Just keep Fontecchio in the starting lineup also for the shooting and move Asar to the bench. Or if Stu comes back, personally, I would bring him off the bench to completely eliminate James Wiseman from the rotation. I mean, if you've had a starting lineup since the trade deadline, that in six games, they were actually good. I mean, defensively, they were better than Monty Williams' unit he started the season with, which was, you know, Killian Hayes and Asar and Stu and Duren with Cade. Like, defensively, they're better. But offensively, they actually function. Like the team we started with to start the season, it didn't function on offense. And that's why it was like a net negative 10, you know? So I just don't understand what they're trying to do in terms of their planning. Like, to me, it's like they don't want to move Stu to the backup center position because they want Wiseman to play. And it's like, that's fine. If you want Wiseman to play, don't tell us we're trying to win now to do all these things, because you're not. You can't be doing both of those things at the same time.
And asking for Wiseman to play now is stupid, and it does not do the player and the player evaluation any favors. This is the time of season where the games for tanking teams don't matter anymore. And with where you've built up to where you have 9 wins now, guess what? Teams are going to rest starters against you. Teams are going to take nights off. Teams are not going to take you seriously. This is not going to give you the ideal data set that you want for the player. If that was the plan, if that's what you wanted, then you should have gotten rid of Marvin Bagley at the start of the season for whatever you wanted. You got nothing for him anyway. What was the point? Even if you got, you know, just one second round pick or whatever for him, it's better than what you got for him right now. If you really wanted to play Wiseman, that should have been something from the start of the season. It seemed to be something that they wanted to do when they traded for him last season. Like, at least just stick with that. We've obviously been critical of Wiseman. I said it before. I can't knock him anymore just because he's been put in probably the second worst situation here on this team, thanks to Monty Williams and Corey Weaver's combination right after Ivy's whole weird situation. Like, Wiseman got thrown into this where Weaver's trying to pump him up as number one. They played him a lot at the end of the last season, but then Monty came in and just buried him now. And now all of a sudden, like, you want to go back to him. That's not how development works. Nobody's going to succeed in that environment, and nobody's going to look good, or nobody's going to get a good picture of who you are playing in a backup unit that's been terrible all season. That's post All-Star break where teams are not going to give you, like, their best shot. And the effort has been going up and down. I mean, I hate to bring that part in the conversation, but as part of why the 9 wins is here, it's not going to help him. It's not going to give you, like, an adequate idea of who he is. And we have 23 games left. You are going to use 23 games to determine whether or not you want to give the number 2 overall pick in 2020 a new contract. You are out of your mind. And again, like, just mismanagement. Like, his cap hold is, like, around 15, 18 million. What are you thinking?
That's how they think. It doesn't make any sense, because what you started pointing out with the Bagley-Wiseman situation, it's like throughout the season, they flip-flopped on what they were trying to do, because by every measure, Bagley outplayed Wiseman the entire time, and then just randomly, they put him on ice. They stopped playing him, and then we go to Wiseman. And it was weird. Certain games that they did go to Wiseman were like must win games for us. Like a game against the Wizards were randomly like, oh, I felt like Wiseman deserved his shot now. Like it didn't make any sense.
Yeah. And if you're out there wondering why that's weird, that would be like if a pitcher in baseball had a catastrophic injury or was gone for a long time. And then when the club brought him back, they're like, now we're not going to take you to AAA. Now we're not going to give you some warm up. We're going to put you in a must win game right now, the bottom of the ninth, and you're going to give like 1,000 pitches or whatever. Like that's what you throw him into. You didn't ease him into it. You didn't like spend all this time to develop. Like, nope, go out there. You got to play defense now for 30 minutes, even though you didn't play at all. Like you played maybe 10 minutes in the last 10 games or whatever. Yeah, it's just been weird with that development path. And I was shocked. I know we tried to record this last night. Things went a little bit amiss. But when I was looking at lineup stuff last night, I was absolutely floored to find out what the most played five-man unit for this Pistons team is. But you already knew, Andy. Like, it was no surprise to you. But to me, I was like, that can't be right. And I remember asking that can't be right. What is the most played five-man unit for this Pistons team?
The lineup that had the most minutes, the five-man lineup, was from the trade deadline. Yes, we're talking about six games from the trade deadline, which had Cade, Ivy, Fontecchio, Assar, and Durin. He's been with the team for six games, and they've logged 103 minutes. The previous lineup that had the most minutes was the one we started the season with, which was Cade, Killian, Assar, Stewart, and Durin. And that was 100 minutes. And these sample sizes are so small that you honestly, even if you're going to use these for any information, you have to go back and look at the actual games and say, well, what happened in that game? And just to kind of make my point, a lot of people are looking at the starting lineup that had Stu against the Bulls, and they look at it and they're like, oh, did you see like the ratings on that lineup? It's great. Because right now, when you look at it, in 63 minutes, they have an offensive rating of 113.4 and a defensive rating of 105.1 for a net rating of a positive 8.3. So it's a great lineup. The problem is, in the 40 minutes before that Bulls game, that lineup had an offensive rating of 103.4, so 10 less points, and a defensive rating of 117.8. So it gave up 12 more points, and it had a net rating of negative 14.4. So you would think it was awful. And then if you try to just kind of say, well, I don't know, we'll take a little bit of this, a little bit of that. If you throw in that the Bulls shot 2 out of 29 from the three-point line for like one of the worst three-point shooting nights in like the last 10 years, it's going to skew your data. So it's like this. Yeah, it's just another point of a wasted season that they don't really know what they're working with.
I know when Fontecchio is in the most used lineup, and how many games did you say he's been here? Six? Like, what are you doing? Everything is just getting worse. Everything's just driving me more and more bananas with this team. And I know that lineup, the Cade, Ivy, Assar, Stu, and Durin, Rich. At Richard Prince _ asked us about this on Twitter of like, when were these games played? I think there were two in like November, right? There was the one just the other night against the Bulls. I had trouble finding the other ones. I thought NBA.com said there were eight games with it. You know when those other games were played where those guys got like actual time together? I would think it was like January, February, like end of January, beginning of February, right?
Yeah, I believe those were January games. And that's the problem with the sample sizes this small is you actually have to go back and look at the actual games to then make context and say like, okay, well, this is kind of what was happening in the game. And this kind of makes sense on you know, the picture that it paints. And just to make another example with this, so the lineup of Cade, Ivy, Bojan, Stu, and Durin. Last season, that lineup never saw the court together because of Cade's injury and Durin not starting to start the season. He was coming off the bench. So they never played together all last year. This season, before Bojan got traded, they spent a total of 40 minutes on the court together. So not even one complete game they spent on the court. And if you look at their numbers, their offensive rating was 129.4. Their defensive rating was 104.9 for a net rating of 24.5. So you'd say this is like the greatest lineup ever. And if you look, I think 17 of those 40 minutes came against the back-to-back, the second night when they played Brooklyn, and Cade and Bojan had awesome games. So, of course, the numbers are going to look great for that lineup. So it just makes it really tough for evaluations.
Year four of a rebuild, and this is what we're talking about, where they haven't even gotten any unit to gel yet. Again, if you're still sitting there saying, you know, Troy Weaver needs to be at the head of this, Monty Williams needs to get another shot. Again, these are strong arguments against that. Year four of a rebuild, you should have at least one distinct unit down. This will be something I'll research here for the next episode, is to look at other recent rebuilds to see, like, okay, by year four, like, who was there? You know, who did they actually find? And who was the unit that seemed to gel by at least year four? I mean, yeah, I don't know what else to say. I cannot believe, again, that the guy they just traded for six games ago is their most, you know, in their most used lineup. It just seems like it can't be true. And yet you look at all the data points and stuff that it is. And like you said, that lineup last year that was supposed to be the lineup with Cade and Bojan and Ivy and Duren and Stu, like, really didn't play together. And then you're like, oh yeah, I forgot all these different things happened. I know part of it's injuries and whatnot, but year four of a rebuild should not be this unstable.
So part of it is injuries, and part of it, because we have had, and the timing of the injuries has prevented us to get a lot of five-man lineup data, because you'd have, you know, Ivy would be sick. Well, first Ivy was benched, so we'll get through that, you know, that stretch. But Bojan missed the first 19 games. And then, you know, Duren gets hurt for a little stretch. And then Stu gets hurt for a little stretch. And then he gets suspended. And then Cade, you know, injures his knee for a little bit. But even sprinkled throughout that, you would have situations where Monty would randomly say, hey, let's try this. Because when Bojan originally came back, Monty experimented with a three-guard lineup of Cade, Ivy, and Killian in the starting lineup. Because I went to that game in Cleveland, which was Bojan's first game back. And it was like, and I don't have a problem with that, except Killian got waived. He's not even here. Like, you wasted all this time and lineup data on a player that is not even here. Like, it doesn't make sense, you know? And I hate to just keep repeating the same thing, but I wish I had a direction. And that's why, even though we beat the Bulls and we should be really happy, I just feel like I have the direction I believe this team is going in is not a positive direction. We have the players, but we have some of the players. But I just don't have any faith in the organization doing the right things to actually make it beneficial and move forward.
Yeah, and 23 games is all that this team has left to really, like, look at what's going on. Fontecchio and Grimes look like they're really going to get the bulk of the minutes. Hopefully we stick to 9 or 8-man rotations, but we know Monty Williams loves his 11-man rotations, even though he says otherwise. Because that should be the rest of the season, is just play Cade, Duren, Ivy, Stu, Asar, Grimes, Fontecchio. Nobody else really matters, right?
Sasser, whenever his knee gets better.
Yeah, I mean, probably precautionary, just to be like, yeah, shut it down, man. But yeah, if he's there, play him. And he's been the other one of, like, they're just wishy-washy on him. I don't get what the plan is with him anymore. I personally feel like he dribbles the ball too much and they're not just letting him fire away from three. Maybe they want to work on point guard stuff, but everything is just maddening in terms of developing, like, figuring out who plays what role.
So I wanted to ask you about Sasser specifically. What has your thought been on his point of attack defense this season?
It's not good, but he's a rookie. I mean, he tries. That's the main thing, is just the effort needs to be there. I still feel like he's better than Ivy in terms of defensive positioning and angles and understanding of concepts. It's the one thing, if you play for Kelvin Sampson, you're going to come in doing that. He's a 4-year player there at Houston, so he should know how to do that kind of stuff. It's just going to take a little bit of time for him to catch up. And then it doesn't help when your center, your starting star center, can't even average one block per game. Stu's been in and out with injury and stuff like that. And then Bagley wasn't exactly like a top-notch defender. Wiseman's there still trying to figure things out. That being said, again, Sasser's defense hasn't been great, but he's a rookie. If by year two he's still not like okay there and fighting and scrapping a little bit more, I'll be more concerned just because they invested a first-round pick in him, believing he can play point-of-attack defense and that he can shoot a ton of threes. Especially if he can't play defense very well. Like, who wants a 6'1", 6'2 guard that just can't guard very well, doesn't shoot a lot of threes, even though he can shoot a good percentage? He doesn't take many. Like, what's the sell for that guy?
Yeah, so those, I had similar thoughts because I've been disappointed in his point of attack defense. But to defend him, a lot of times they haven't kept him as like the primary defender on the other team's ball handler because they switch so easily. It has been nice since the trade deadline to see that, I believe, with Grimes and with Assar, they've made more of an effort of just saying, you guys are going to fight through screens, stay with those guys, and we're going to do less of this like soft switching. And I think if they would have done that more with Sasser, that would have kind of showed off more of what he can do. So I'm not out on him, but like what you said, if his at his size, his defense has to be excellent. If it's not excellent, then it wasn't a good pick because he's not going to be a primary enough scorer to make up for his deficiencies size-wise.
Yeah, I mean, pretty much at that size, you either have to be Seth Curry or you have to be Jabon Carter. There's really no in between there. Guys like Dennis Schroeder have squeaked by, but even then, like I've mentioned before, he's bounced around the league. And there have been teams that just don't want him because he either doesn't take enough threes, he demands the ball a lot, and then his defense just isn't up to par. Even when they're good at every other thing, they still put severe limitations on what you can do. Especially if you're trying to give him the ball more, this team does not need somebody else that needs the ball more. They need guys that fill the role around Cade and Ivy. Everything is around Cade and Ivy. As I said in the Royce Webb post that I did for a Substack the other day, shout out Royce Webb. Go follow RoyceWebb.com. If you didn't, I did a little breakdown of, like, you know, in the short term and the long term, what do the Pistons need to do? And that was just the main thing for me. Everything has to be around Cade and Ivy. They've already wasted enough time with Monty's nonsense of pushing Ivy out of the rotation even. You got to know what do they look like together? How well do they function together? Everything has to be around Cade and Ivy. If every player you sign, every player you draft now isn't helping that, what's the point of it?
Yeah, and Monty's, you know, all bench approach, I think, hurts a lot of things in terms of the Pistons have less talent than other teams. So you have to have a smaller rotation if you're going to try and match up because you're at a talent deficit. But if other teams are playing a 9-man rotation and you're playing an 11-man rotation, you might even have players who are hurt. It's like you're playing like sometimes the 12th guy on your roster and other teams are only playing 9, like, and you already have less talent. How do you expect to like match up in these games?
I know, it's like, what's your biggest deficiency? Depth. Okay, what's your game plan for? Play everybody. Like, what? Those things do not match up. What are you doing? Just like, right. I think maybe part of it is like worrying about injury. That if that was my only guess of like, oh, we don't want to, you know, push Cade or Ivy too much. But I mean, come on. I still don't understand the Ivy situation. You know, I'll never understand that. I don't think anybody will ever until Monty Williams just comes out and like explains it 20 years from now or whatever.
Yeah. And even with that, when you're looking at like running someone into the ground because of their minutes, give them a game off and then like let Sasser have a game where he plays 30 minutes. Like do the same thing with like Grimes. Like those guys could do that. And I just don't understand where you think it's beneficial to play like 12 guys and nobody's in any sort of rhythm. Nobody knows if they're playing tonight or when they're getting in, or it's just, it's baffling. Where I would have liked to have seen, you know, Cade and Ivy staggered and Sasser used more off ball, Duren and Stewart staggered more. So Wiseman's out of the rotation. Like there's just so many other things that they could have done that it just seems like Monty has his approach and he's going to do his approach. He puts guys in a certain role. And once you're in that role, like you can't, he's not going to change. And it's bizarre though, because like, I think it was that Brooklyn game that I was looking up, that it was, he actually staggered it quite a bit. And I think it was because Cade got in foul trouble, but it was less of the all bench nonsense. I think just because it kind of broke his normal plan. I think that's what we have to hope for. Things that break his normal plan in order for us to get better rotations.
What would you like the rotation to be like in the last 23 games?
In the last 23 games, I think you could get away with playing just those eight players that you mentioned. Just those core eight. So we have Cade, Ivy, Assar, Fontecchio, Duren, Stewart, Grimes, and Sasser. And then depending on foul trouble or injuries, you use a Troy Brown Jr., or you maybe have to use a Wiseman for a couple minutes because of big man foul trouble. And maybe you throw in Fournier just for a few minutes. But that's it. You just use those eight guys and play around with that to kind of see how it fits. That's what I would like to see.
So I actually want it to be nine, and I want the ninth guy to be Fournier. I think Fournier has actually done nothing but good things since being here. He's shooting 43.5% on 3.8 attempts per game. He's shooting more threes than he's shooting twos. He's gotten in people's faces. He got teed up in that one Pacers game because apparently Tyrese Halliburton doesn't like you pushing his guys. Like, come on, man. Are you really going to be that soft? Like, he's shown attitude and fight, and he's shown, like, I understand what my clear role is. And he shoots threes. He's, like I said, everything needs to be supplementing Cade and Ivy. You can put that guy in the second unit. The smart thing would be to stagger, like pull Cade out, let Ivy run the second unit, right? Let Ivy run the second unit with a Sasser, with a Grimes, with a Fournier, with a Stewart. That seems like something that could be fun. I'm not thrilled with the idea of like Evan Fournier or Quentin Grimes as the power forward, but why not? Nine games, who cares at this point? Just surround Ivy with shooters. That guy is going to be impossible to stop. When Stu is able to be the worst shooter on the court, that seems like a second unit that is going to terrorize people.
I like the idea of what you're saying. The only problem is with Monty, you would end up having like Grimes and Fournier trying to create and doing the stuff and Ivy standing in the corner.
Yeah, but see, I know like Ivy should be the only one really touching the ball like 25 to 30% of the time in that lineup.
But to me, that would make what you're saying makes complete sense. And I would agree with that role. And I would have no, because he's a shooter. He can shoot. And so I totally agree with that role. And that was one of the things that scared me a little bit. I think it was a quote from one of their practices where they were just talking about Grimes. But they always say this for every player where they're like, yeah, I want to show off like that I can do a little bit more in terms of like the playmaking and the ball handling and this and that. And it's like, no, like defend and shoot threes. Like that's what we want you to do in the offseason. Sure, show, work on whatever you want to work on. But getting into a role to support the other players, that's what we need.
I mean, in Grimes' defense, he's taken 5.3 three-pointers to just two-point shots now, so he's clearly that way. And so far in his NBA career, he's been like, I want to say over like 60% three-point attempt rate, I can tell you. I mean, it's been way skewed of like he's busting threes and not taking too many two-point attempts. Yeah, as a rookie, Grimes was 80.4% three-point attempt rate. As a second-year player, 67.6% three-point attempt rate. And then this year, between the Knicks and here, it's been over 74%. So it's clear. It's been over 72%. Excuse me, 74% flat on the year. And since being a Piston in just three games, 72.7%. He's clearly known like where his money is. And he has come in and filled that role. He hasn't shot a great percentage yet. He's only shooting something like 25%. I believe, yeah, 25%. But I think it'll come back around. You know, shooters go into slumps. Sometimes when you get traded like that, it's not ideal situation. And he has played with the terrible second units. So that can't be helpful to anybody's shooting percentage. But I definitely believe in Grimes. Hopefully, he'll end the year on a hot streak because he is going into a contract year. You definitely don't want to be looking at figuring out what to do on the guy, the worst shooting slump in his career. kind of figure out the number that you want to pay him. But yeah, Fournier, I'm not going to say like pick up his option or anything, but if they could somehow like renegotiate for a team friendly deal, I wouldn't be opposed to bringing him back. Because one of the things I will say in the off season is just everybody that's a good shooter, just sign him. Like, you need to bring in as much shooting as you can, from the big acquisition to like the last guy that you sign. They have to be a good shooter.
Yeah. If we had a different coach, I'd be all for that. That would be fine. Renegotiate the deal and bring him back. But with Monty, it just scares me because we don't know. We don't know if he's going to bury a young guy on the bench forever because he's got some veteran that he needs to play. And I understand you have to balance it out for winning, but yeah. So who's someone who's been playing great basketball on this team that needs to get more attention from these recent games that we've had?
Probably that guy named Cade Cunningham. In the last 22 games, so I want to dispel the, oh, Cade's been playing great since coming back from that knee injury. No, it's not just since coming back from knee injury. His number since December 18th. So this is going back his last 22 games from December 18th all the way until the last game against the Bulls on February 27th. Last 22 games, Cade Cunningham has scored 23.7 points per game, pulled in 4.6 rebounds, 7.7 assists, 0.9 steals, 0.6 blocks. Shooting splits are 50.3% from the entire field, 42.7% from three on 4.7 attempts from deep per game, and then 82.4% from the free throw line on 4.6 attempts per game. The overall numbers, too, if you look at Cade Cunningham's overall numbers on the year, I seem to remember people, and they still seem to see people now talking about, oh, Cade's not the guy, he's super inefficient. Well, Cade's shooting splits for the entire year, all 48 games that he's played, 49.7% from two-point range, 36.1% from three, and then 85.3% from that free throw line. That translates to a 55.3% true shooting percentage. Pretty good.
Yeah, we haven't had concerns about Cade. We've always felt comfortable that he is the guy to build around. He can do many things. I think it's nice. It's really nice to see this. I don't have questions about him. What I would like to see is more of an effort made to see what the other guys can do as far as their fit. And that's why I do like Asar staying in the starting lineup, because I feel like we have to figure out, can he be on the court with Duren, which I believe he can, and not take away too much from Cade? Because if it takes away a lot from Cade, then you have to question, like, is it worth doing this?
Oh, and by the way, Cade is 15th in the entire NBA in assists. Remember, he's only played 48 games. He missed quite a bit of time. And he has 353 total assists to just 171 turnovers. And his turnover rank now is 7th in the NBA. He's between two guys named Anthony Edwards and Paolo Banchero. Huh, I wonder if those guys are pretty good too. So you still have problems with Cade and you don't think he's the guy. Like, I'm not going to argue with you anymore. You just are a hater. Agree to disagree. See you later next year when Cade's flirting with all-star numbers.
And I believe in the preseason, you talked about you expected Cade to have giant assist numbers. I know that kind of got thrown out of whack because Bojan started the season hurt, and they decided to start Killian Hayes instead of Ivy, and it kind of threw the whole offense into, I don't know, one of the most inefficient offenses we've ever seen.
It didn't affect his numbers on assists, though. And before he got hurt, he was constantly in the top 10. If he doesn't get hurt, he might even be cracking top 5, especially in those last 22 games, 7.7 assists. That's top tier. His playmaking is still just on a whole nother level. For the year, his assist percentage is, let's go take a look at that. Assist percentage is 34.6% for the entire year, which is a career high currently. And his turnover rate is 14.9. His usage rate is 29.7. Those are all good numbers. Anybody that's over 25%, that's a lot of usage. anybody that has under 15% turnover rate on that high usage takes care of the ball, and anything over 30% assist percentage means like you are one of the best playmakers in the NBA for sure.
What are your thoughts? Because I swear every game he'll have at least one or two passes that are turnovers that it's just like, what are you doing? Because he is so talented and gifted. And sometimes he'll make a pass where it's like, what was that? Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, he has supreme confidence in his teammates, no matter who they are. Go look at that Oklahoma State team. Somebody posed the question the other day of like, who's better in college, Ben Simmons or Cade Cunningham? And my initial answer to that question is the one who played. Not to say Ben Simmons didn't play, but I mean, go look up anything on documented on Bill Simmons or Ben Simmons, Bill Simmons. Yeah, Bill Simmons is seasoned at LSU. Ben Simmons is seasoned at LSU where he just coasted through the year. He got that team at Oklahoma State to the NCAA tournament. There's not a single guy that even got like a two-way contract that even saw like an NBA tryout on that Oklahoma State team. No offense to those guys. I only bring that up because if you look at the LSU team, there are like four or five guys that at least had some NBA time, found their way into the G League. So it's not like Ben Simmons was playing on a talent deficient team, whereas Cade Cunningham didn't play with a single NBA player. And he still got that team to the tournament, made it into the round of 32. The ultimate fell to Oregon State, I want to say there. But Cade always has belief in his teammates. He will always try and find them no matter what. And there are some passes he makes that are that. They're believing that the teammate is going to be there or believing like, hey, I'm going to try this out here. The one thing I will say about it that I don't have a good answer to is like, how many of those actually turn the tide of a game? This team's been so terrible in Cade's time. I don't have an answer for that. I probably have to go back and look at the Oklahoma State games, but I don't remember them ever like murdering you in one way, shape, or the other. And in terms of being a playmaker, I feel like Cade does it on both sides of the ball. I implore anybody to go back and look at the game he had against Wichita State. I believe it was like the 10th game, or it was pretty early in the season there at Oklahoma State. Cade only had 10 points in that game. I mean, he stunk it up, but he hit the game-winning shot and he had the game-winning block. I think that's where the playmaking stuff comes in. And I think the turnovers just get overblown because they do stand out so much. And because he is such a fantastic playmaker that you're like, why would you do that? But I think the most like accurate answer can be he always believes in his teammates and he's always going to do everything he can to get them the ball.
So do you have any final thoughts on Cade or Muscala or our wonderful coach or GM?
Well, fire Weaver, fire Monty for sure. But in terms of Cade, as long as Fontecchio, Grimes, Fournier, Sasser, these guys do have supplementary shooting and keep their numbers up, I don't see why Cade doesn't finish the year out like closer to 50, 40, 90. He's already really close to 50% from two-point range. The 40% from threes probably like unrealistic, though, if I'm keeping it real, because Cade's at 36% right now from three-point range. Yeah, 36.1. I mean, he would just have to hit like every last single three-point shot the rest of the way. And 90%, it's not out of the realm of possibility there. He's 85.3% from the free throw line, but that one also is there. So if he's like 50, 38, like 86, that would be what I'm hoping for, how he finishes out the year, because he has been on a tear even before injury, coming back from it. And everybody seems to gel, even though we're both appalled and freaked out that Fontecchio has been in the most used lineup. It's a good lineup. It's one that they need to keep going to because it's helping him and Ivy a lot.
Yeah. And that's why, honestly, and you could put Asar on the bench. You could put Stu on the bench. I just like having that shooting out there for Cade to give him space to let him work. I would just really like them to try and find some more answers instead of, I feel like they're just trying to pound a square peg into a round hole to make whatever their vision was to make it happen. And sometimes you got to say, you know what, this isn't working as the record this season should show, and, you know, move forward. I mean, if you look back, we started in Summer League complaining because they were playing Duren and Wiseman at the same time. Like, do you know how absurd that was? And people were telling us, like, oh, you guys are silly. It's Summer League, blah, blah, blah. But it's like, they've never done that during the regular season. So basically, you're telling me you're wasting your Summer League reps. And we've just talked about how inefficient they are. It's just everywhere. They just don't make sense. It's like they don't have a vision and a direction of what they're trying to accomplish. It would be nice at the end of this season to walk away feeling confident that it's like, hey, I think they might have a direction. I think they might have a clue what they're trying to do here.
Yeah, and I do want to end this talking about Jaden Ivey, because if you pull Jaden Ivey's stats from that same time, starting at December 18th, ending at the most recent game against the Bulls on the 27th of February, you will see that Mr. Ivey is averaging 17.6 points per game, 4.1 rebounds, 4.4 assists per game, 0.7 steals, 0.7 blocks. Shooting splits are 44.6% from the entire field, 38.9% from three on 5.1 attempts per game, and then 71.3% from the free throw line on 4.7 attempts per game. Those are really good numbers to look. Cade was averaging like 4.7, I think, threes per game. Ivy's averaging 5.1. So we're talking like around 9 to 10 threes between the two of them every single game. Both of them are averaging around the same free throw attempts. Ivy's a little ahead, 4.7. Cade's is 4.2, so it's around 8 to 9 free throw attempts per game between the two of them. I mean, there's their superstar whistle. They can average, you know, KD and LeBron numbers between the two of them at least. That can help out. I mean, I joke about it, but that can help. And if one of them does get the more superstar treatment, that's just going to go up there. And their playmaking, both of them are really good playmakers. Again, you see the difference between, and I'll still push back on this. This is not to diss on Ivy. This is just to try and talk down the people saying like Ivy and Cade are the same level of playmaker. They are not. 7.7 assists versus 4.4 assists per game is like I'm Jason Kidd versus I don't know, whoever you want to say is below that kind of level of playmaker. Ivy is a very good playmaker, but he's not up there in that elite. Maybe he does get there one day. Who knows? He's a smart guy. He naturally knows how to pass the ball and where to find guys, especially when he gets to the rack. I mean, again, all that's exciting. Only bit of criticism I do have is just for Ivy of like, you got to tighten up that free throw shot. 71.3% is not good for a guard, especially for somebody that gets to the line that much. If he shot it like Cade, where he's up another, what is that, like 14%? That's probably another like 100 points for Ivy just right now. Like he's got to get better at the free throw numbers. And there was a section here when Cade was gone where Ivy was shooting like 60% at the free throw line. I do not know what happened. That's definitely got to be the thing that Ivy works on next, is just making sure he's like 80% at the free throw line. I don't know if he ultimately gets there, but it would be something that I know he could work at a lot. And with his drive and his work ethic, like he can focus and hone in on that. Because if he's shooting 80% from the free throw line, then that's just somebody you don't want to foul, even though he's already somebody you don't want to foul to begin with. And it's just going to add there. So Cade's and Ivy's shooting has gone up. Their free throw numbers have gone up. It's an exciting pair when one's 23 points per game, the other one's 17.7. Both good playmakers, both getting better as shooters. It seems like it could work. We'll see how they fill out the rest of the team. And Fontecchio, thank you for being here. Grimes, let's hope you can start knocking them down more. Fournier, Stu, as well.
Yeah, just to add on to Ivy, I know he does stuff every game that I will just like shake my head and be like, what was that? But then the very next possession, he will do something where you are just like, oh, you know, he got to the free throw line. Oh, he drive and made a basket. Oh, like you talked about his defense earlier. He comes up with this block. And I just feel like, especially with where this team is at record-wise, let him go. Let him learn. He seems like somebody who is going to learn from his mistakes. He's going to improve. And like we talked about before, how they say, you know, everybody has work ethic, you know, at this level, and it's a lot of BS. I do believe he's like a worker above and beyond like what they say for the normal NBA worker, because you can see the improvement. You can see it when you watch him. And I'm willing to see those plays where he turns it over or he travels or he gets an offensive foul or The only thing I don't like is the no-look passes that he throws into the crowd. Like those he could cut out. But it's like, I'm willing to deal with the mistakes because I just see the potential of how much pressure he can take off Cade. And I know it's a very simplistic view, but I just look at the touches at the end of the game. And when I see that he's down in like the 30 to 35 touches, it was not a good game for our team. And when he's up above 50, the team is just completely different. And that's just because he's involved in the game and he makes things happen. And I truly believe he's one of those people that is a winner. He wants to win no matter what. If he ends up sitting on the bench, but the team won, he will not be upset because the team won. And I believe that just from watching how he's handled all this nonsense this season. So yeah, I'm high on Ivy. I agree.
Yeah, I agree with all that too. And him and Cade seem to be of one mind as the season has worn on. I've said it before on the episodes before this. I think even when the team isn't really running sets or whatever, Cade and Ivy are coming up with things on their own. You see them talk. You see them play off each other. There have been instances where they'll like screen for each other. I don't know if that's really in the playbook. It should be in the playbook because both of them have size to where they can be guard screeners and be pretty effective at it. And if those are the two playing off each other, like how do you defend that kind of stuff? I know I've been really critical of Ivy's defense. I still think it's not good. But as Bryce Simon and Mari and Sean Windsor brought up in their most recent Pistons Pulse, they talk about Ivy's second effort being really good this season. I think that has been a big thing this season is even though Ivy still doesn't always get in a defensive stance, like he's on his heels and people will catch him and he does dumb things like that. His second effort has been really good. And that Bulls game, I think he had like two blocks where he got beat and he was like, okay, this is my technique. I'm going to run trail and get the block. And he did. And that kind of stuff matters, especially in a season where you have 9 wins. I mean, I've been critical of Duren, and I mainly have been critical of Duren because I've seen things like that with Ivy to where he's progressing. He's saying, okay, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to compete. I'm still learning these things, but I'm going to give second effort. And I don't think I've seen that from Duren, but that'll be something we'll talk about here towards the end of the season. I know I brought up the block numbers in the season before, but I really want to see how Duren has responded to that recently with a little, I know these good performances where he's had like 4 blocks, 3 blocks. That's good. Hopefully he can keep it up, but we'll see how the season ends. Because I really want to see how the season ends for Duren on that end of the court before I, you know, unleash the research that I've given where Ivy, you can at least say like, oh yeah, look at that second effort. There's progression there for sure.
Yeah. I'll be looking forward to listening to what you have to say about your Duren research. But I'm going to be looking for the next few games to see very critically how the offense looks starting Stu. And unfortunately, my gut is going to tell me that the offense is going to take a hit. And I don't think the defense is going to be great enough to compensate for what happens on the offensive end. And I hope to be wrong. I hope everything keeps on clicking. And regardless whether or not the offense is working or not, I would love to see Stu get up like 6-7 threes a game because that's the only way he's going to stretch the floor is to be a volume shooter at a high enough percentage that teams actually change how they guard him. That's the only way floor spacing changes. And if he's shooting at like 37% or whatever I think he's at this season, it's like, let the man.
That's 37%. Yeah, it's 37%.
Yeah, let the man shoot the ball. Let him shoot the rock.
Yeah, and the other night against the Bulls is a good one because he went 0 for 3 in the first half and then he hit 2 in the second half. And it's like that, if he does that the rest of the way, 6 threes, and especially if he's clanking them in the first but knocking them down in the second half, that's what you want to see.
All right. Any closing thoughts, friend?
That's it from me. So let everybody know where they can find you one last time, Andy.
You can find me on Twitter at D_D_Pistons_fan. Since we've basically waived everyone, I think we possibly can waive now. I think we're at the deadline.
Fournier is the next one, just because I brought him up. You know they're going to waive him now. So I guess March 1st, it's tomorrow's the deadline, so we'll see. So, maybe we're going to end recording this and open up Zitter and be like, oh no!
Yeah, with the way that the paperwork works, I think they all had to be in by now to get processed in time. So I guess we're rolling with who we got now and we'll see what happens. And we'll see if maybe we use that empty roster spot to pick up someone interesting. But the reality is we've got 8 guys who should get all the minutes. And I mean, I still would love to see some Stanley Moutet get some minutes, because the man can shoot the rock and you can't have too many shooters. But other than that, just roll with what we got.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, we're always going to ride for Stanley Moutet until he gets some actual shine here. Andy doesn't know this, but this is our 101st episode. So Jam and I did the 100th episode beforehand. So I wanted to do this again to say thank you to Andy. Andy's the first co-host we had here. Honestly, like, I didn't really want to co-host at first, and it wasn't until Andy came in that actually had like knowledge, and we're not just sitting up here like overly positive or overly negative about the Pistons, but trying to take a data driven thing, try and find statistics, try and find patterns and all that stuff. So the Lord blessed me with a great co-host here, Andy. You opened up the doors for me too, to be like, I should bring in somebody for the draft side of things too, because again, I'm antisocial. I don't think like I've really talked about this before, but seriously, I'm just like, people know, even at my job, like when they have us do committee meetings and, doing the staff meetings and whatever, I'm like, can we just do it through Zoom or whatever? You know, do I physically have to be there? But you made me realize, like, yeah, I should bring in a draft, expert as well, because it's just much more fun here. That's the main thing. You've made it a lot more fun, as well as be objective instead of just being like a rant all the time. Although I guess the season went kind of gone on more rants because of how bad it's been.
Wasn't our fault, man. Wasn't our fault. But no, I appreciate it. And when you offered, I took it, because just listening to you, you have a very balanced approach that so many people, and we all have our biases. I'm not saying you don't have your biases. We all do. But you're willing to listen to the other side and then question your opinion and then reevaluate from there. And not just in this topic, but in other topics in life, just from talking, outside of basketball. And so I truly appreciate your point of view, not just in this, but in other things, because you're a well-balanced person, which honestly, there's not that many people like that.
Oh, yeah, that's for sure. So thank you so much, Andy, for being here. Make this thing so much better. And just like I said with Jam 2, the bump in viewership and people that listen to this, when I was doing it by myself to when you came on board, like, there's definitely been a big bump, and you're a big reason why. You're maybe the only reason why.
Great work. You have a great work ethic. Just keep it up, man. I expect more from you now.
Speaking of which, I started the Substack again. So go check out the Big Board 1.0 that I did post. I think it was last week there. It's my first ranking for the 2024 draft class. I'll probably update it like after conference tournaments there. Give a little bit more time to get some things going and revise. I'll try and post next week about the guys that didn't appear on my first big board. There are a couple of like big names on there that didn't appear, like Johnny Furphy and Keyshawn George. And I'll give my reasoning as to why. Some of them are like, oops, my bad, I didn't spend enough time on film. And others are like, I'm still not sure what to do with them. But keep an eye out for that. So resball.substack.com. Subscribe to that, please, if you can. If you love NBA draft stuff, look there. I mainly do draft things there. Occasionally, I'll post about the Pistons thing. Like last year, it's pretty much when I started it because of the James Wiseman trade, and like just not understanding any of that stuff. So check out the Substack, resball.substack.com. So thank you again to Andy. Yeah, to everybody listening, and we'll catch you next time. We'll go on it.